Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to Radiolab.
From New York Public Radio.
Public Radio,
WNYC.
And NPR.
If you want your animals frisky, you start as early as possible.
Today's show is about animals.
And at 6 o'clock, there would be crowds of people flowing, pushing each other out of the way, jostling, laughing, streaming towards the venue.
About people getting close to animals.
You had hundreds of lions and panthers, cheetahs, you had a baboon, you had an Indian rhinoceros.
And about what happens when we bring animals into our world.
The slaughter is unimaginable. There is roar of the crowd, there is musical instruments rallying everybody up.
That's Marina Bellariskaya. She's a historian, and what she's describing is Rome, 80 AD. If you were lucky enough to be alive then and get a seat at the Roman Colosseum on a good day, you could watch, no joke, hundreds of animals slaughtered right in front of your eyes, one after the other. All kinds of exotic creatures.
The populace never knew what would take place. That was part of the agitation. They wanted the suspense. They wanted the tension.
Right. So now that you have that picture in your mind, consider this one.
A baby gorilla!
Here we are at the Bronx Zoo, the gorilla exhibit, and what you've got are, well, no blood, no cheap thrills, just kids.
You see the baby on the back?
On the back.
Like a piggyback ride?
Lots of kids smushing their faces to the glass, trying to get the attention of the gorillas on the other side.
Mommy, look, I'm a gorilla!
Gorillas aren't really noticing. But then, and this is the big moment, one of the adult gorillas turns around, walks to its side of the glass, and taps.
The gorilla taps his hand on the wall.
Today on Radiolab, we wonder, how did we get here? I mean, throughout history, even before Rome, our relationship to animals was pretty simple. We brutalized them. That's how it worked. Then in the 19th century, someone created the zoological garden, which wasn't much better. And now we've got the zoo, and we still lord over the animals, but now we want to be their friends. We want to help them. How did that happen? And how exactly do you help an animal? And this is an honest question. When it has to spend its entire life in a cage. Today on Radiolab, zoos are our topic. I'm Jad Abumrad.
Well, you know, I think I can take you to the very moment in modern zoo history when the balance kind of shifted.
And who are you?
I'm Robert Krulwich, and I love the zoo. What about you?
I don't know about the zoo. Kind of, icky.
Why?
I want the animals to not be there in the cage.
Be someplace, what, prettier, safer?
Safer, prettier. I'd rather watch them on TV, frankly, and let them run around their own.
Well, the guy, this is interesting. The guy who made the big move in modern zoo history.
Hello.
That's him.
Hello.
His name is David Hancock. We got him into a studio. And he's sort of a little bit like you. He was very ambivalent about zoos.
I'd actually, for a while, toyed with the idea of, do I want to go and work in zoos and try to change them, or do I want to stay outside zoos and work to close them down? And I came to the conclusion that there's no way you're going to close zoos down. The fascination of wanting to be close to wild animals cuts across every strata of society.
You know, this is my case, by the way. I love being close to him. Anyway, David Hancock's decided if you can't beat him, you join him. And it was in the mid-1970s, and David was working actually as an architect. He was between jobs. When he got a call, a friend recommended him for a job at the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle.
Yes, yes.
And he gets hired.
I was in an unusually fortunate situation in that just after I was hired and got there, the zoo director left.
And so there was nobody to run the place, well, except for David. So he decided to take a look at the entire philosophy of the zoo and change everything, starting with the gorillas. They lived in awful cages.
The gorillas were living in a small concrete building.
It was a spare empty concrete box with a glass window.
The gorillas, of course, were bored and slowly going out of their mind.
Occasionally you'd find a gorilla who'd take his feces and smear it on the wall.
Yes. I mean, they had nothing else to interact with. The only natural components in his life that he ever came into contact with would have been the food that he ate and the feces that he produced.
So cages were the problem. The solution, he decided, well, he wanted to rip up the cages, yank them out completely, and replace them with something, a natural setting of some sort. But when he looked around for a model, no zoo in the world had gorillas in what you would call a natural setting, and he wasn't even sure. What is natural for, say, a gorilla?
There was very, very little known about gorillas and their wild behavior. In fact, all the books said that gorillas don't climb.
This was early in the 70s, remember? So David invited a person who did know.
I heard about Diane Fossey. Diane Fossey's work was beginning to be carried in National Geographic.
You know Diane Fossey.
And yeah, from that Sigourney Weaver movie, she played the Sigourney Weaver player.
Before she was played by Sigourney Weaver, Diane Fossey was an actual person.
Yeah,
she
right.
lived with a group of gorillas, wrote down everything she saw, their social interactions and all, and was the gorilla expert at that time.
And I heard that she was coming to the U.S., and she agreed to come to Seattle and spend a couple of days with us. We were trying to get images from her of the sort of environment we could create. And the breakthrough came after the couple of days she'd spent with us. I was driving her back to the airport and I said, is there anything you've seen around here or anywhere in this part of the world that in any way resembles the sort of places where you've seen gorillas in the wild? And she just pointed to this verge on the freeway.
I don't know what a verge is. What's a verge?
A verge. Oh, sorry. The landscape on the side of the freeway, the sloping, what would you call it?
I would call it, if it were President Kennedy, I would call it a knoll. Oh, what do they call it?
A knoll.
Yes, a knoll. But I wouldn't call that because only President Kennedy gets
no.
that. I would call it the green stuff on the side of the road.
Okay, yeah. It was a banked area that had once been cleared. And then this verdant growth that you get in Seattle was springing back. And she said, that, right there, that's where I would expect to see, to be observing gorillas in the wild. So I dropped her at the airport, came back, and on the way back, illegally parked on the side of the freeway and took photographs. And then said, here, this is what Diane Fossey said we should be designing.
So as you could tell, they had absolutely no idea what they were doing. But they also didn't have a boss. And within a few months, with help from a landscape architect.
Hi, I'm Grant Jones from Seattle, Washington.
They drew up a plan, and out came the bulldozers.
Exactly. And we were creating huge mounds and hills about 10 or 15 feet high, some rocky cliffs along one side,
a creek,
trees, shrubs about 3 or 4 feet high, big herbs and vegetables and tangles of vines, undergrowth, and lots of laurel bushes, hawthorn trees,
big comfrey leaves that we planted
that have long berries and pointed and drip tips, tropical-like leaves,
fast-growing pioneer plants.
We just let it grow wild.
Now, nobody was watching you.
And nobody was watching us. And that was the critical factor, I think, yes. Because if a traditional zoo director had seen or heard what we were doing, he would have stopped it.
And why? Why would a traditional zookeeper have stopped this?
Well, because they were worried about what would... Like, suppose you had been a gorilla, and you'd spent your whole life living in a cage, in a concrete cage.
Right.
And now I'm going to take you, little Chad, my baby gorilla, and stick him into a completely new place with sky and jagged things. I mean, I would be worried that you'd hurt yourself.
In the zoo world, generally, I think people were very nervous about it.
That's Violet Sunday. She was the gorilla keeper at the Seattle Zoo.
Yes, I was their primary keeper at that time, and the zoo was advised by a lot of zoo experts that it wouldn't work.
I had zoo directors tell me it was stupid, irresponsible, and it was unnecessary.
That, you know, the gorillas would fall out of the trees and hurt themselves.
If the gorillas climbed, they would fall and break their necks.
Fall and break their bones, or they'd get...
We were putting their health at risk.
Diseases.
They would get sick because it wasn't a sterile environment where you could, you know, disinfect concrete.
And that they'd get psychologically deranged from all this space.
Yes.
Sometimes I'd go to David Hancock's and say, what are we going to do about these people? He'd say, ignore them.
A bold statement. But as the clock ticked down to the day that these five animals would walk from their iron cage through a door into this field, It was a real open question at the time, what will happen?
I think we were all somewhat nervous.
Oh, we were nervous, oh sure. How will they react? What will they do?
The truth is, nobody knew. And so after 5 years getting ready, after 16,000 square feet of guerrilla display area were prepared, finally, it was time.
On this sunny July, it was a July morning.
I can't remember the exact year. I think it's 70s.
Actually, I just looked it up. July 31st, 1979.
We let them out. Kiki was the first to come to that doorway and look out.
Kiki was the dominant gorilla of this group. There were six gorillas. He was the star.
Kiki was my favorite, I have to confess. He was so smart.
And he was big. He was 6 feet tall, 460 pounds.
Kiki came into view first.
And of course, he's never seen anything remotely like this before.
So here he is, this huge creature standing at the doorway, just looking at this unknown world.
He stood in the doorway for many minutes. And finally, Kiki starts to slowly step forward.
First a step, then another.
And he went as far as a creek and sat down. And then he looked up. We noticed he looked up for a long time, and we looked up also. Clouds were blowing by at fairly low altitude. Swallows flying overhead. There were crows in the trees. There was a wind blowing. The trees were rustling. The grass was moving. You could see the hair on his face moving. He looked up for a long time and took all this in. And then he looked down into the water in a little eddy there, and you could see that he was looking at his face in the water, which he'd never seen. And then he just starts looking all around, and then all of a sudden he sees us.
Grant, Violet, and David and a few others were standing behind some glass at an observation point. They were about 100 yards away from the doorway.
And he came right up to the glass where we were.
And they knew that Kiki had been a pretty angry gorilla before.
And then he did something that we in a million years hoped he never would, which was to reach down into the sand, screwed his arm down deep into the sand, and he pulled out this big chunk of broken concrete about 6-8 inches wide. And then he held it up over his head. We thought, oh, this is it. He's going to break the windows. We'd spent weeks raking and telling the contractor to remove all debris and begging them to check and recheck to look for such things as this piece of concrete, and there it was. So Kiki held it over his head and sort of waved it around a little bit and looked with an angry look at us.
And he just held it there.
And then he just dropped it. He almost threw it down. He just sort of dropped it down. We all breathed a sigh of relief. And then he laid down on his back, and his mate Nina came over and sat beside him, and a little baby came over and laid on his chest, and they just proceeded to enjoy themselves like we weren't there.
It was magic. It was magic. They looked like different animals.
Totally different animals.
It felt like we were seeing a gorilla in the wild.
Needless to say, we all cried after he came over.
I didn't cry, no, but I had a lump in my throat.
I felt like, finally, this is right. This is really what's right for them.
I remember there was this strange feeling afterwards. It was almost like we'd been to a wedding where there was this mixture of happiness and sadness, and I think more than anything else, though, it was just a great sense of relief.
We thought, well, when will he produce this angry behavior and pound on the glass? And, you know, he never, ever did it. The old Kiki never returned, never filled his body again.
He was never angry anymore?
Well, I think what he's saying is that Kiki had really changed. The change in cages truly changed the animal here.
Well, this is an interesting science question to ask about that. It's like, if you do that, if you take an animal and put them into a radically different environment, mm-hmm. how exactly does that change the animal?
Well, it clearly makes him feel better.
Can you measure that?
I think the closest we've come to an answer to that question is Elizabeth Gould has actually done a test with primates where she's put them in different types of enriched environments.
That's Joan O'Lara. He's a science writer and regular Radiolab contributor. And what he's talking about is a Princeton experiment. A group of scientists led by Elizabeth Gould took three groups of monkeys and put them into three different kinds of cages, sort of like classes, social classes. Like she divided them into a lower, a middle, and an upper. So we can go through each one. Let's start at the top.
One group of primates, group A, was in the Beverly Hills of cages.
Describe it.
Lots of different monkeys running around today, lots of social interaction. They had to forage for all their food, lots of toys.
What kind of toys, you know? Squeezy toys or like balls? It doesn't matter. So they had lots of choices to make, lots of things to be engaged with, lots of conversations to have.
Yeah, lots of stuff to occupy their mind.
What about group B, the middle class?
Group B had, you know, we'll call it like the standard suburban setup. Not too fancy. They drove a Chevy.
what are we really talking about here?
They just had a bit less of everything. They had a few less toys, a few less monkeys in this grand enclosure.
So we can say that they had less.
Yeah, they had less. Then the third group was kind of the standard experimental enclosure, you know, wire cage.
So they had a lot less.
Yeah.
All right, so you've got these three classes of monkeys, upper, middle, lower. Mm-hmm. Gould and her team put a bunch of monkeys in each class, let them do their thing for a while, and then they took a few of individuals from each of these groups and looked at their brains.
So they looked at the amount of proteins you have in your synapses. They looked at the density of your dendritic arbors, which is...
Did you just say dendritic arbors?
Yeah, that's right.
That's a great name.
They look botanical.
Especially when they're happy, those little cells.
You mean like each brain cell branches out in all kinds of different directions when it's happy, so you get a kind of a bushy kind of a feel?
Yeah, exactly.
What does that mean if I'm an animal? Is that good?
Well, yeah, they think it is. I mean, you can't exactly ask a monkey or a gorilla, are you happy? Are you doing okay in that cage? But you can look at their brain cells and ask, are they branching? Are they growing and making new connections and getting full and bushy? That's what these scientists wanted to know. Which of the class of monkeys had the bushiest brain cells? Because those monkeys would be the ones that are most engaged with their world, most alive. Okay, Jonah, so jumping forward, Elizabeth Gould looks into the brains of individuals from each of the three classes.
Yeah.
And what did she find?
She found that there's a big difference between the impoverished and the middle class.
Big difference between the bottom and the middle.
Yeah, the bottom and the middle is a big difference.
How big?
It's very significant. It was generally between 20% and 40%.
40% bushier brain.
Yeah.
Wow. So what about the difference between the upper and the middle? What was the difference there?
There's almost no difference.
What?
No difference at all?
That's the weird thing. Between the lower and the middle, huge difference. Huge. But between the middle and the upper?
They really couldn't find much.
Why?
Well, I think the lesson is at a certain point, a tipping point is reached and your brain says, okay, we're in a complex world here. We have enough toys, we have enough social interactions, we've hit the tipping point, let's go full throttle, invest in new neurons and a nice, complex brain.
All right, let me ask you a question. What if you're a zoo animal and you're living in a crappy wire cage and then they move you to a nicer one? Mm-hmm. What would happen to your brain then? Has she looked into that?
Yeah, and she's found that within 4 weeks.
Four weeks?
About a month, the brain itself has changed. It begins to flourish again.
And how long did it take, you say?
4 weeks.
Holy moly.
I mean, this is just 4 weeks. Imagine what it looked like after a year.
Yeah.
After just 4 weeks, they saw significant changes in the basic architecture of their brain.
So, Robert, just imagine Kiki now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A gorilla whose brain has been stunted by 8 years of living in this little concrete box. Suddenly, Kiki is thrust outside,
right,
where the weather changes.
Birds fly, the rain falls from the sky.
Where trees sway when he climbs. Suddenly, Kiki has challenges, choices.
Right.
And to think that after 8 years of being stuck, his brain could explode with new activity in just 4 weeks?
I mean, but that makes sense, you know. Nature has to respond quickly. They don't, you know, most animals don't have 4 years to sit around and develop a complex brain.
Yeah.
Our neurons have to act fast.
The message from this research is clear.
From the perspective of the brain, you can easily create a cage which allows the brain to flourish.
You see, I told you that if you make the zoo better, you can make the beasts better. This is built in. Zoos are not horrible places.
No, I know. But before we get ahead of ourselves, okay.
Keep that in mind.
Yeah, let me just throw one more category into our little class hierarchy here.
Okay.
The category of creatures who live in the wild. No cages. So in a sense, this is like your lab.
Yeah.
He's paid a visit to a guy named Fernando Notbaum.
I'm a biologist at Rockefeller University in New York.
And that's where we are. We're in the woods outside his lab, which stretch for thousands of acres. And he calls these woods his real lab.
Such a chickadee.
That right there? Which one? Oh, they're little teeny guys, huh? And in the trees are his subjects.
What these birds do is in the fall, they start hiding seeds or nuts throughout the forest. And they have to remember where they put them. Winter will come, and at some point, everything will be under a blanket of snow. So if you remember where you hid those seeds, you'll be the survivor. Because, I mean, in the case of chickadees, which are very small, for them to be alive the next morning, they'll have to go to sleep with a full belly.
Is that because their metabolism is so fast?
Right, right. I mean, they're small birds. They lose heat like mad. It's a cold night. It's long. It lasts 10 hours. I mean, you go to sleep with an empty stomach. Next morning, you're dead.
Knowing this, Notbaum did an experiment. He caught a bunch of wild chickadees, divided them into two groups. First group he put in a cage. Pretty big cage.
10 by 5 by 3 or something like that.
Second group, set free. So they could roam the woods as they pleased.
Over this home range of about 30 acres.
He did place bird feeders throughout the woods so they'd come back and visit him. Winter time rolls around. The wild chickadees are out there, snatching seeds from the bird feeder and hiding them everywhere.
The cracks of bark or, you know, crack of a stone.
How many hiding places are we talking about here?
We're probably talking about thousands.
Thousands?
That's a phenomenal memory task.
The caged chickadees, meanwhile, didn't have to remember anything because they could eat as many seeds as they wanted from a little trough in the cage. Notbaum did a brain comparison. And what he found was that in certain brain regions, the wild chickadees had twice as many new neurons.
The free birds.
As the caged ones.
Were recruiting twice as many new neurons as the old one.
Twice.
Twice as many.
You know, that process of replacement was moving at a much brisker pace.
His theory is that these new neurons are always showing up every day, like day laborers. The only question is there a job for them? In the wild group, absolutely, we need your help to remember where we put all those seeds. In the caged group, there's nothing for those neurons to do. But here's the sad part. They still show up, you know, every single day.
I think it's a period of a few days over which a neuron either gets a job or doesn't get a job, and he dies.
So it just offs himself?
Yeah, you don't get a job, you're gone. You don't have to kill yourself. You're just not going to get what it takes to stay alive.
Which makes it all the more poignant to me. I mean, in the captives, you've got all these new cells. They're ready to do some work.
Yeah,
Come on, give me a job.
Precisely. Yeah, they'd love to do it, but it's a shrinking economy, guys. What can I do?
Thanks to Fernando Notbaum. He's a biologist at Rockefeller University in upstate New York. And also, before him, to science writer Jonah Lehrer, who is the author of the upcoming book, Proust Was a Neuroscientist.
And coming up, what does a ferocious, meat-eating, 500-pound feral cat eat for dinner at the zoo?
What?
It's such a disappointment. Well, no, I don't want to tell you.
This is Radiolab. I'm Jad. You're Robert. And we will continue with our program on zoos.
Zoo. If you think zoo, what an unusual. Don't you wonder like where it comes from?
We have to go to break now.
It used to be zoo. One second. It used to be called the Zoological Gardens, and then it got this like short name.
Yeah, what is it?
A song.
Let me introduce you. This is the lovely Miss Lou. In
1878,
song here
called
is
Walking in the Zoo.
Walking in the Zoo. Walking in the Zoo.
After people heard the song, they just couldn't think of a place in any other way.
Walking in the Zoo. Walking in the Zoo.